Investing Simplified is brought to you by Chuck Price, President and Wealth Manager of Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm and author of Investing Simplified, the book. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest-running live financial show in America, with a financial advisor, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and is broadcast live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. Chuck can be contacted by visiting www.pfgwm.com. You can email Chuck with a question at askchuck@pfgwm.com. Or you can call him right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. Or for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, here's the host of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price.
Well, hello, Portland. This is not Chuck Price. This is Kevin Stege, CPA with Baker and Coulson, PC, CPA firm out in Gresham, Oregon, and I'm here in studio with the other cog in the Investing Simplified team, Carl Jepson of Carl Jepson Law.
The third leg of the stool, yes.
That's right.
Well, good day, Kevin.
Good day. You need all three legs, and there's only two, so we'll be a little teetery, but we'll get through today. I think we'll get through just fine.
Yeah, I think we're in pretty good balance, really.
There we go. Yes.
So.
Yes, that's right. Well, we welcome your questions. We would love to have you call in with your tax or your estate planning legal questions. Obviously, guaranteed financial returns. We'll come up with any number you want on that with Chuck gone, which we always do. But no, just facetious. Chuck's not here. So we'll save the detailed financial planning for a later show or an email to him.
Yeah, actually, we have to give our usual disclaimer, which is this is an educational show, just general information. Make sure that whatever you hear on this, if you want to implement it or something, go see your own professional before you do it. We could be actually wrong. So there you go.
Can we? Okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, hope not. But,
yeah, that's true.
Because we don't know all the facts. That's the big deal. There,
yes. So. And, you know, Carl, this that's little statement usually doesn't get taken care of when you're not here. So it's good that you're here. 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. You may have a question regarding the new tax laws. We've been getting a lot of those lately. I think we're starting to kind of get some regulations to figure out how this is going to apply for 2018 and going forward. And a lot of my clients, a lot of folks have made changes to their tax picture, their tax plan, their payments and stuff based on, how the new law is going to affect them.
How's that first $20,000 thing working out? How's that? Isn't there sort of like this first $20,000 of certain income kind of treated in a different way?
Oh, are you referring to the 20% deduction?
Yeah.
That's a big thing. That's a, boy, oh boy, that's for any businesses, and we're finding rentals are going to probably qualify. There's a number of limitations and thresholds, but for the most part, that's not going to apply to the majority of us making under $315,000 if you're a married couple, or half of that if you're single. So. But if you've got active business income or rental income, and there's all sorts of variations, you should be able to take a good portion, 20%, as a deduction, and that's going to be pretty significant for a lot of folks.
And is that in addition to like what would be called the standard deduction?
It is.
It is. No kidding.
Yeah. So you get your standard deduction. You don't get exemptions anymore. The $4,000 roughly is what it was at per person. That went away. Standard went up significantly, standard deduction, and now this 20% business deduction really helps those who are working, owning businesses, typically employing people. So Wall Street got their tax changes with the lowered corporate maximum tax rate. Maximum, remember, it's not just everybody's paying less taxes. It's the maximum rate has been lowered. Mm-hmm. And that helped also bring a lot of income and assets that were out of the country back in to be used for domestic development, which is a good thing. And, you know, I kind of wanted to talk about that just a little bit. I don't have a ton of insight into all that's going on in the economy. I'm not a financial advisor, but I run into a lot of things. And one of the things I've run into is there's a report called the CPA Outlook Index, the CPAOI.
Well, I think that's a good way to look at it. It seems to me that the CPAs have a very good business-like approach to things and aren't necessarily trying to – they're not trying to puff it up to sell themselves.
That's a good point. And you know, a CPA in public practice gets exposure to a huge amount of businesses and segments of the economy. So this Outlook Index – is something they've been doing for a while, and it kind of just is, it's kind of lick your finger, stick it in the wind, you know, type of thing. But it gives a feeling of the CPA's optimism for the future here. And it is at a second all-time high. Mm-hmm. When the index hits 50, it means 50 or 51 and above indicates that there's favorable impressions of the future economy and where things are going, and anything below 50. Well, right now, the CPA Outlook Index is at 79. All-time mm-hmm. high is 81. So, you know, that's a pretty good measure of, you know, it's across the whole country and all. So,
what kinds of stuff do they look at?
Oh, you're getting into the details on that. I just put it away. Revenue, profits, employment, IT spending, U.S. economic optimism, organization optimism, expansion plans, you know, what are people doing with all of those things? And it seems like there's a lot of activity in a lot of that. So it's a lot of factors. If you want a copy of the report, email me.
You know, I think it would gather dust on my desk.
Probably so. And I also wanted to talk about, I've had a segment prepared for some time, in fact, all the way back to the NBA draft and the NFL draft, about athletes and high income earners and the things that affect them and their taxes. This tax law change is going to be kind of brutal to them. You know, they don't have businesses. They're employees. Yeah, the long face comes out. I know. But in general, you have an athlete and they pay a chunk to their agent. Well, as an employee, the only place to deduct that is Schedule A 2% unreimbursed employee expenses for this person who negotiated your contract. Well, that section is gone now. And when that's you can imagine what the agents take. So that's a pretty significant thing. But one thing I wanted to chat about was, and I ran across this article, I thought it was a pretty good one. It was in Forbes, and it was an interview with one of the top financial advisors in the country. I'm bringing this up because Chuck's not on the show here.
So it wasn't the most
very influential.
Good. No,
good
okay.
point.
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. I needed that cover. So, and this guy specializes in high income folks, celebrities, sports people. And in fact, they have a division specifically for athletes. And I wanted to kind of see what are some of the planning things that they do at the high-end level that apply. And I've kind of talked about a week or two ago about a few things that I've run into with some of my clients, some of them good, some of them not so good. I haven't run into a lot of these things that this guy talked about. This is pretty significant. But in general, the crux of what I've gathered, and I ran into this back about 5 or 6 years ago when the Dodgers owners had a divorce, and when you go through a divorce proceeding, that becomes public record in court. Mm-hmm. And so we got a perspective on finances and how everything was laid out. And for the most part, a lot of these really wealthy folks, a lot of the tax planning revolves around borrowing on their assets. And, you know, because when the accounting cycle, basically taxes come due when you've got a full cycle in the accounting and you've turned an asset into cash. When that happens, in general, you're paying taxes. Well, if you have an asset and you decide to borrow off of the value or the equity, obviously, a franchise like the Dodgers, you've owned it for decades, that thing has grown hugely in value, but it's not cash. You can't spend it.
Right.
You're no different position, so to speak, before, you know, where you were 30 years ago. But if you borrow off of that, and so that's, you know, they've got financial instruments, they've got ways to do this and that and stuff. So, you know, and they live off that. And then, you know, apparently when you pass away, you really don't care what interest and this stuff happens at that point, you know, so it may not be the cheapest way, but it's probably cheaper than paying taxes on, you know, selling.
You know, actually, it's not that uncommon. I have clients every now and then who say, well, and I'll say, well, what happens if, you know, your children die before you? And they say, well, I don't care. You know, I mean, a lot of times, not very often, but occasionally they do. It's, you know, I don't, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, one last comment about the economy before we go to our first break. We have got no callers so far, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. Just a comment regarding housing. It's getting to the point in some cities in the United States that is cheaper to rent than to buy and maintain.
That's new.
Yeah, and in general, what we're looking at is 41% of people living in 41% of the people live in a county where the median income to buy a home at the median list price, the median income, is not sufficient to buy a home at the median list price. So that's starting to get to the point. And I remember this back in like 2006, where I was making a decent salary, nothing, you know, wild, but I was making a decent salary, probably better than the average. And you wanted me to go out and spend $250,000-$300,000 on a 30-year-old ranch home that needed tons of upkeep. It just didn't make sense. And we're kind of getting back into that territory.
Yeah, there are some. I see this in the probate situation where we, you know, sell the decedent's house, and I've been amazed at some of the prices that we've gotten for some of these houses that are. I mean, not that they're bad. It's just that compared to what I've seen before, the values were just way up there. But I think that there's being a pullback now. I don't think we're quite seeing that there were a lot of flippers that were doing, you know, the throw account, you know, a gallon of paint on the thing and turn it for another 20%. So I don't think you're seeing quite that much anymore, but so it's stabilized, I think. But
yeah. Well, anytime people that have made a lot of money in real estate, when you see them not so excited to go out and buy and being selective and actually renting or advising their kids to rent for a bit, you know, that's interesting. I don't think we're in a position where we've got all of these bad loans that are just absolutely going to blow up like 2000 and, you know, 8 and 9, 7 and 8 when that all happened. But, you know, it'd be interesting to watch where real estate goes.
You bet.
Right.
You know, buyer beware.
That's right. We will take our first break and we'll come back with Carl's comments. Again, we do welcome your calls, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. We'll be right back with Investing Simplified.
Hello, my name is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and co-host of the long-running radio talk show, Investing Simplified. My law practice emphasizes estate planning and probate. My mission statement is practical estate planning for peace of mind. This means that I listen carefully to my clients. I explain the various estate planning techniques and documents in the most understandable terms that I can. I try to make sure that my clients are comfortable with what we are doing together before proceeding, and I discuss my fees up front so that clients don't get any unwanted surprise. Estate planning and probate don't have to be that complicated. My experienced staff and I work closely with our clients to guide them through both of these matters in the simplest and most efficient manner possible. My office is located in the White Office Building at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, right across the street from Mall 205. My telephone number is 971-229-0585, and my website is carljepsonlaw.com.
Got a legal question? Coming up is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney, with Carl's Comments. You can call Carl now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepsen.
Well, good day and welcome back to Investing Simplified. And it's nice to be back. I've been out and about for a while, and I haven't been unoccupied, but I have been doing these things or the other. But before I start my comments, which I will tease you a little bit about, it is the comment is, living trusts can be like a fine automobile. And we're going to talk about that when we get to it. But in the meantime, we do have a caller. And caller, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
What's your question, sir?
My question is, if you own rental property, can you sell the rental property and buy stocks and bonds instead of doing, for example, a 1031 exchange into a different rental property? I don't want to pay taxes is what I'm looking at.
I see. A 1031 exchange can only be real estate for real estate anymore. You cannot go into stocks and bonds.
Okay. Well, that answers my question.
Yeah. Very good question and good thought process. However, it's always been like kind for like kind, and they have groups of what those are. But now with the new tax law changes, a huge amount of like-kind exchanges are no longer available. It is literally real estate for real estate anymore, and that's about it. And it can be a lot of different types of real estate. You know, you could get into an office partnership somewhere that, you know, owns an office building type thing. You know, and so that would be borderline kind of an investment, but it's not, you know, true stocks and bonds.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for your help. Have a good day, guys.
Thank you.
Well, I think we were intercepted one more time. It looks like we have another caller on the line. Caller, you have a question for us.
David. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Question for Carl, please.
Sure.
In the successor trustee section of our revocable living trust, the successor trustees are our two children. Is it possible to remove the clause that says by right of representation, because that's the way it's worded there, which means one of our children's children, or do you have to rewrite the whole trust?
Oh, no, you wouldn't have to rewrite the whole trust. You could do an amendment to the trust that just changed it to whatever you really wanted. But I think there might be a slight confusion on the term right of representation. It usually refers to who gets the money. In other words, if, say, for example, if one child dies, their share goes to their children, you know, or your grandchildren by that child under right of representation. Whereas the trusteeship is more of a, you know, an appointment or nomination of who's going to do it next. And so either way, you could do it you could change those things by amendment pretty easily.
Can we eliminate the grandchildren if we so chose?
You can. You can write them right out of there.
Okay.
It happens all the time. You know, it's one of those questions that I often have with folks, and it's not an unfair question, because things are so complicated these days in terms of everything that a lot of times there are very strong reasons why they want to avoid, you know, giving a share to someone, you know, or several someones. They want to do that, and they want to make sure that that happens. And those are you can usually do that. It depends on a lot of the most common one, I think, is the son-in-law or daughter-in-law. They like their daughter a lot, but they're not so much sure about his husband, you know, or vice versa. And those things are a little tricky because, you know, obviously if you want the money to go to your daughter, but she's still married to the husband that you don't like, you know, what are you going to do? It's not that easy to do what you might want to do, but a lot of that depends on what daughter or son wants to do. So,
according to what I understand, our living trust is upon both my wife and I's departure from this earth. It goes into two separate trusts.
Well, it depends.
One for daughter.
Yeah, you can do it that way. Ordinarily, if your estate is what we would call a taxable estate, then on the death of the first spouse, there's usually the establishment of at least one other trust, and then at the death of both spouses, there is a distribution provision that usually applies to both trusts, but a lot of times it leaves the option open for the surviving spouse to dictate where some of the assets would have gone different than when they had before. Right. If they do certain things, and that's typically called a power of appointment. But a lot of times it's a default clause. It's just at the end of the day, if that isn't used, then it goes to however they set it up in the first place. So if you said to my kids and then my kids' kids after that, that's how it would go unless you changed it sometime in the middle.
And that's called power of appointment?
The ability to change it. Is oftentimes called a power of appointment. And there are several different kinds. One is called a general power of appointment, which is basically they can give it to anybody. But the other one is basically a limited power of attorney, and that usually means that the surviving spouse can't appoint the property to her creditors, her estate, or her estate's creditors. She can appoint it in, say, different amounts to, say, the children or other specified persons. So I don't know whether that makes any sense.
what you've just told me is that it's a jungle.
Well, it can be. I mean, there are ways, you know, that people can get around things. But a lot of times what if nothing else is that by setting it up in a certain way, and if somebody violates it and suppose it's the trustee and basically says, I'm not doing that, I'm gonna give it any way I want to. Well, then even though they might, you know, they have the ability to grab the money, they don't have the legal right to do that. And so that means that the people who were rightfully to get that money pursuant to the trust do have a cause of action against the trustee to make them do it right. So that, I guess that's kind of the end of the day. Like so many things, it's, you know, if people refuse to do what they do, that's what courts are for.
That's the bottom line, Carl.
Unfortunately, it is. And, there's that's a challenging way to go. But I think that the trust a lot of times minimizes the likelihood of doing that. But it can't guarantee. Nobody can guarantee that they're not going to sue you somehow.
Correct. Okay. Thank you.
You bet.
Bye.
Okay. Well, it looks like we also have one other caller. Looks like Julie. Are you on the phone?
Hello.
Hi, Julie.
Yes. I'm calling about my uncle's will.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand everything here, but it says the value of his will is over $50,000 less than $1 million. Is that $50,000 less than $1 million?
Yeah. That's the way I'd read that.
Okay. Well, it lists his estimated assets.
Uh-huh.
And it goes into detail, his bank account, his life insurance, his vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes up with a total. And then that was by the his, I guess you'd call it, personal representative submitted that. Yeah, his personal representative submitted those assets. And then when you go to read his will that was mailed to me, it lists different people. I'm one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And you add up the amounts of money that he listed in his will,
mm-hmm.
and it's a lot more than those assets that were listed by his personal representative?
Well, that's not uncommon, and the reason for that is that, you know, I don't know when he did his will, but it could have been a long time ago. And those are the, you know, those would have been a list of assets that were done at the time the will was prepared. And since that time, maybe he's been in a nursing home, or he's spent the money, or lived on it, or given it away, or squandered it, or something. And so you can't guarantee that you're going to get what's at the will says. In fact, typically the will generally doesn't say how much it is, or what it might say what it is, but not necessarily how much. Some things end up getting sold. It's quite common that people will, as they age, will sell off real estate and use the money to defray their expenses of living in an assisted care or whatever it might be. And that's pretty darned expensive. Can diminish those assets very quickly. So now the inventory that the personal representative puts in is supposed to be the estimated value of it now, whatever it is now. And that isn't necessarily an absolute guarantee of that, because it's really an estimate. And it's also a gross value. For example, if there's a home in it, and it's worth $300,000, but there's $150,000 mortgage on it, you would list that as an estimated value at $300,000, but you wouldn't factor in the $150,000 mortgage until you got around to distributing things. So it's a little tricky, but that's usually the discrepancy between what it was then and what it was now. It's just whatever they did in the interim period of life, letting things happen.
Uh-huh. Well, I know that he went to a foster care home, but I don't know how much that cost.
Well, in today's world, that can run anywhere from $1,500 to $4,000 a month or more.
Oh.
Yeah, oh yeah. It's big time money.
Okay.
I'd make that $8,000 a month or more.
Oh, $8,000. My CPA says I'm too conservative.
I've seen some big ones.
Well, okay. So you can see it could be a big amount of money. And that can, go a long ways. I mean, doesn't take very long to run out of money at that kind of level.
Yeah, well, that's what I thought that to be frank with you, I think that the personal representative is not an honest person. And so I don't know what she could have done with the money, because she had power of attorney, she could have spent a lot of money. On herself, possibly.
And therein lies a problem, because what you're kind of suggesting is maybe there was some financial elder abuse going on, and there are statutes that deal with that and stuff like that. But a lot of times that's very difficult to prove. But more importantly, a lot of times if someone with a power of attorney or some other way have absconded improperly with the elder's money, the fact of the matter is the money's gone. And they spent it on something, and so that's, unless it's found out early, it's very difficult to collect on those. Even though the person can get in some trouble for that, but that doesn't do any good for getting the money back. So a lot of times, it's one of those things where I think the most important thing that seniors can do is to make sure that they have someone that they really trust that's kind of overseeing their finances, so that they're, I don't mean necessarily doing it for them, but at least saying, no, don't spend that. Don't give Uncle Tizzy that thing. It's not his stuff. It's your money. You need to keep
it. He didn't have any control over his money at all. She handled it totally.
Well, right. And that's what I mean.
He didn't know what was going on.
And that's the problem, is that a lot of times the person that they, there are times, and there are people that make a habit of it, that really prey on elderly people by going to them, and they first of all befriend them, and then they do them favors, and then they all of a sudden start telling them that all of their relatives are wrong, and that their relatives are just trying to steal their money, and that they're the only ones that are going to take care of them, and they really need to give them the title to their house, and the next thing you know, the guy's broke. So that's what I'm saying, and unfortunately, the elder person can be easily swayed by that, especially if they're beginning to lose some of their cognitive abilities. They may not be incapacitated, but they may be a lot less capable than they were, say, 10 years ago. So it's a difficult thing, and I think one of the things that you can do is set up some, first of all, make sure that the people that you deal with, that you're going to have as fiduciaries are really going to act like fiduciaries, meaning that they're going to look after your best interests, not somebody else's, like their pocketbook.
Uh-huh. Well, he just said she was the favorite. She's my cousin, but she's not an honest person. So that's why I kind of wondered about these assets, how they are so low. Mm-hmm. But I know they should be, in my opinion. But I don't know the exact amount of time that he was in that place either, being taken care of.
Right. Well, you would have a proof problem on this one to go backwards and get all those records and find out where the money went. And so I you know, you could certainly run it by a lawyer who does elder abuse kind of litigation. But I you know, I don't know whether they would be, you know, because obviously they're going to want to recover. And so, and you don't want to spend a whole lot of money chasing money that you can't get. So I would, you know, you could certainly do that. And if you wanted to, I know a few of those lawyers. If you wanted to give my office a call on the week, I can locate one of them for you. But my guess is that they would be not overly enthusiastic about doing that.
Uh-huh. So basically what you're saying, though, is that when those assets that are estimated are stated and they don't go along with what the will says, the fact that I'm listed on the will may mean nothing because I may get zero.
Right. That's true. Well, uh-huh. If there's some assets and you're listed, and also being listed on the will makes a difference as to how you're listed. You might be listed, if you're listed as an heir or listed in the petition as an heir and not as a devisee, then that's a difference because you can be an heir. That is somebody who would be entitled to something if there's no will versus someone who's entitled to something when there is will. And that's the devisee part. And they send notice of all that stuff to both of those people, but only the devisees, only the ones that are named in the will to get stuff.
Well, the way it's listed is specific bequest, and it lists his daughter and myself and my sister who are nieces, and then at least list then my nephew, and then my niece that is getting the big money, who is the power of attorney.
Mm. Well, there again, that's something you'd have to look at the specifics of the language there. But sounds to me like maybe he made her the devisee too.
That's like when it's a list of people like that that are all nieces and one nephew.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that you could be listed on the will and not necessarily be entitled to anything under the estate.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I don't know that without reading the will, so that's a challenge.
Uh-huh. Okay. I just wanted to kind of figure out what was going on because it didn't make any sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the differences in the money, and it appeared to me like all this money had disappeared because I knew that he had quite a bit of money.
It's easy to see how that happens, and I understand because we see that. But from what you tell me, that's what it sounds like, that it did get spent. So
yeah.
So anyway,
or partly, maybe, no telling.
right. Well, thank you very much for your call, and
thank you.
Please keep listening. And we're going to take a quick break now. And this is Investing Simplified. We'll be back in a little while.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management. Price Financial Group Wealth Management.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Colson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Colson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercolson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercolson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Colson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
Do you have a tax question? Here's your opportunity to ask Kevin Stege, CPA and shareholder of the Baker Coulson CPA firm, that tax question that's been keeping you up at night. You can call Kevin 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's the CPA with the tax answers, Kevin Stege.
You're listening to Investing Simplified, and those were some scintillating calls. Very good information, Carl. Thank you for that. I just had one comment to make on our last caller to Julie, and this is regarding the inventory and maybe just another way to look at it. When the will was created 20 years ago, what's listed on usually Exhibit A, which lists the assets that the will is covering, that was what those assets were 20 years ago. And now when the person passes away, you're looking at what are the assets now? And there's obviously significant changes. Sometimes those have grown. People bought more houses. Principal residents have been sold, new ones purchased. Or like you say, foster care home takes a chunk out of it. So the assets change over the time when the will was funded, drawn up, and the time that the person passed and the new inventory for the court. And Carl, I run into this. When I'm doing an inventory for tax purposes, I need to look at all of the assets. When you do an inventory for probate purposes, you're not listing such things as IRAs, correct?
No. Yeah. Yes, you're right. You're correct.
Yeah.
We don't list those things.
Yeah, exactly, because they're not part of the probate inventory.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's always a difference between the legal aspect and the tax, or like life insurance. That's, anyway, various things. So
The life insurance goes outside the will.
Yep.
And so, yeah, that's the other thing that is important. And in fact, that's one of the thoughts that comes up a lot of times is that many, many people today have a substantial portion of their wealth, their property in 401ks or IRAs, and or life insurance. Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of assets are transferred at death by a beneficiary designation that's with the company, and that goes outside the will. So if you put in your will, I want my IRAs to go to so and so, and you don't change the beneficiary designation, you're not going to get there from here unless there's some amazing change.
That's right. That's right.
So one of the main things to do is to be concerned about coordinating your beneficiary designations to go to the right place and the right people.
That's right. Well, our lines are open, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. And Carl, I guess I'm curious to find out how a living trust can be like a fine automobile.
Well, right. And I promise it's not a 1967 Cobra. It's like, a Rolls Royce or whatever.
Oh.
Something, a fine automobile, something. But or it might be just, a Toyota Camry because they work and run forever. But anyway, basically, living trusts are a great thing. Their number one thing that they do best is to avoid probate. And one of the things, the trust has to be constructed well, just like a real good car. And it has to be put together so that, works for everybody. However, just like a fine car, it requires some maintenance from time to time. And this is one of the areas where people, I think, get a little bit confused. So one of the things, first of all, when you set up the trust, you have to transfer most of your assets into the trust. This means a lot of times that you got to go to the bank or to the broker or to some other company and fill out a whole boatload of paperwork. And only you can do it, not the lawyer. I can help you with it, but the lawyer can't fill it out for you and can't sign it for you because he's not you. And so you have to go in and a lot of times what we do is just give instructions to them, to the companies to do it, but have our clients sign it, and then they go in and they get their paperwork fixed up. But then doesn't always guarantee that it gets done right. So the client really has to do that. The other thing is that from time to time, assets change. We were just talking about the difference between what it was when you start and, life happens between that time and now. And, for example, it's not uncommon for people to, say, refinance a house. Well, if we've put their house in a trust and we refinanced it, then more often than not, the lender will require that the property actually be transferred out of the trust and then transferred back. Unfortunately, what happens is it gets transferred out, but nobody thinks to transfer it back. Well, then all of a sudden you've just defeated the whole purpose, because then you're going to have a probate when the person dies. So you got to have some maintenance going on there. That's something that you got to be mindful of. The other thing is, and this one really gets different, is when if you have a taxable estate, which in Oregon is over, I would say over $1 million, $1.5 million or whatever, $1 million is the minimum, then if your trust is set up to try to take advantage of all of the tax laws, it will usually set up a procedure whereby you split the assets into two or more separate trusts. Unfortunately, that requires some significant work. That may require going around to banks and getting things signed and getting an EIN number for a new trust. Those things take time, and most people don't know how to do it. So they find it being a little bit upsetting, I think, when their spouse has died and they're faced with some work. Unfortunately, there's no way really around that in most cases. You just can't make it a seamless thing. If you have a non-taxable estate, then it is pretty seamless. Then you really don't have to do very much, if anything. But if it's a taxable estate, you're going to have to do several things at least, and maybe quite a few. One of the things that we recommend is, remember, the taxable estate is everything you have. So don't, if you've got a probate estate or estate that's property that's in your name only, say you have $1 million worth of real estate, but also you have $3 million worth of IRAs or something like that, all of that counts. All of that goes into the gross estate and has to be counted as part of the estate. So my suggestion is to avoid those unpleasant trips to the bank and all that kind of stuff, is to periodically, first of all, when you get your trust set up, ask your lawyer, what do they have to do? And a lot of times I have a little checklist of things that people do when the spouse dies, because it could be confusing. And the other thing that comes up is, I'm sure Kevin can vouch for this, is that a lot of times the spouse gets everything by operation of law, by beneficiary designation or whatever it is, and it goes directly to the spouse, and that means that it has benefit of deduction, the unlimited marital deduction, so they don't have to pay any tax.
Yep.
But it doesn't mean that they don't have to file a tax return. Right. If their estate is over, if their half is over $1 million, they got to file a tax return. And people say, well, that can't be right. Well, yeah, it is. And so that's one of those things that we kind of have to tell you. If your estate's over $1 million, there's a likelihood you're going to have to file an estate tax return, which is a fairly complicated deal, which involves lots of bank trips, lots of forms, and also appraisals and appraisal fees, and maybe even some lawyer fees, and then you have to at least tip your CPA for doing the tax return.
That's right.
So it can be a fairly challenging event. So there's some maintenance that goes with all of this stuff, but the advantage is that if it's all done right, it'll avoid the probate and make things easier. The trust also benefits people by giving them a mechanism whereby a trusted individual or trusted entity will manage their affairs in the event that they become incapacitated. So there we go. We have it. I see we have a call.
Let's take our last break, and we will come back to our caller. You're listening to Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management. Financial Brew, Wealth Management. We do Investing Simplified.
Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you
really understand how your Social Security benefits work. Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
What you don't know can hurt you. Get that legal question or that tax question answered now. Call Carl or Kevin now at 503-417-9595 or toll free at 877-733-1011. Now, here's Carl Jepsen and Kevin Stege.
You are listening to Investing Simplified, and we'll go right to the phones. Kathy, are you there?
I am.
How are
Thank you?
Yes.
I have a question for Kevin.
Yes.
My sister is a personal representative for our aunt's estate in Washington State. She died in March, and we know we have to have a 2018 tax return, but she does. She has less. Or it's only in Washington State, and will she have to do a tax return for the estate if her, you know, she's under $6 million?
Okay, Washington, their threshold is for per person is about $2.1 million or so.
She has less than that.
Okay. Does she have any Oregon property, real estate?
No.
Okay.
No.
I would say, just at first blush, it does not sound like she has an inheritance tax return to file.
Okay.
Yes.
That sounds very good. And are we able to do a 2018 tax return for her for those first 3 months before the end of the year?
You know, you can. That's difficult. You're basically trying to have somebody, usually an accountant, figure out what the income is for those 3 months based on brokerage statements, IRA deposits. It's better at this point. You're only a few months away from the end of the year. Wait for the 1099s. You'll do a 3 month final 1040, and then potentially and probably a 1041 starting on the date of death until the time the assets are distributed. And a 1041 is a fiduciary income tax return. The decedent final 1040 picks up the 3 months, and then the 1041 picks up for the estate any income made after the date of death until the assets are distributed. So,
and she's encouraged to file those before the end of the year so that she can make distributions, and so is it possible to do that? I mean, you said that it's more work, and she has gotten the information about all the income before and after the death.
Sure. Well, 2018 forms aren't out yet. However, we have had some success with lining out 2017 and handwriting 2018 in there. I don't recommend it. It's a fine dance between the legal side of things of closing out an estate and the tax side of things and the info we need to file a final tax return. Usually we do what's called a holdback. And Carl's nodding his head, and that's where you roughly figure out $5,000-$10,000 for any potential income taxes, whatever it may be, maybe $20,000, maybe $50,000. It can be a large holdback. And
yes, that's what they're suggesting to do.
Yes, and that lets you make most of the distributions and except for this holdback amount, and then the tax returns are prepared. The K-1s for the 2018 or 2019 returns are calculated. The tax prep fees, the tax liabilities are all paid out of that holdback, and then whatever's left, maybe, you know, a little bit gets kind of passed out in a final distribution. Some estates don't want to do a second little final distribution. For some, it's no problem. It's just brothers and sisters, and they just divvy it up. For others, they need an actual amount, and that's where you lock yourself in on that holdback, and that's the final amount, and there's one distribution. And that usually happens when there's many beneficiaries, and making a second distribution isn't practical.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. That really helps.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Any additional thoughts?
No, I think that's absolutely right. It's very common to have a holdback because, like you say, you don't necessarily know always what the taxes might be. A lot of times there aren't any, but sometimes there are, and you want to make sure that they get paid. Because one of the things you have to do is when you're the personal representative in a probate, you've got to sign off on the final papers that says under oath that you have paid for or have made arrangements to pay for any, you know, taxes that are due.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you for the call, Kathy.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Very good. Well, Carl, continuing your topic, which I thought was very good, in general, I tend to look at, in deciding, you know, and this kind of gets in the legal side of things, but I do chat about it with my clients. Obviously, I don't give them legal advice. That is left to those who specialize in such things. But I tend to look at, for an Oregon resident, I tend to talk about $1 million per person.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you over $1 million per person, or are you under $1 million per person? And maybe that's not the best description, but if you're under that million, now you've eliminated estate tax planning issues. Now you're talking mainly about probate and distribution of your assets and how you want that to work. So just to simplify this, let's the name of our show, Investing Simplified. So say you're a single person and you have under $1 million. Okay, now you don't need estate tax planning, most likely, unless you win the lottery. Now you need to determine, are you going to pay for a will while you're still alive, which is probably a good idea not to die intestate, or are you going to take the next step and pay for a trust while you're alive, set up a living trust, and avoid probate? And one of the advantages to doing that is it lets you control your assets after you pass away. You can put it, your living trust can create another trust. Well, a will can do that. The will can do that also. If you have, say you're a married couple and you have $1.5 million, anytime you're over $1 million, you need to consider some simple ways to avoid the estate tax here in Oregon. And there's a number of different ways to do it. You can do it through your will or other ways. But I digress. We have 3 minutes left. We have another caller. Maria, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Hello, and your question?
Okay, my question is this. I have a residency in the United States, but I am Mexican. And I was married to an American person like 35 years ago, and he was audited, and there were some taxes that he didn't pay. They found them, and he died. We got a divorce just before he died, and they allocate that amount to me. That was like 35 years ago, and I had never paid. It started with $30,000. Right now, it's about $270,000.
Oh,
and
boy.
I don't have money to pay.
I see. This, unfortunately, I don't have a ton of insight for you, but definitely contact somebody, probably a CPA is what I would recommend, and you'll pay them a little bit of money, but it will be money well spent to look at innocent spouse or some sort of relief. And especially at that dollar amount, I think you have a very good case to probably either pull your liability away completely or get it adjusted way down. It sounds to me like it's a ton of penalties and interest because it wasn't paid. You have some options, and I believe if you have somebody who knows what they're doing, contact a good professional who can do that. I don't really specialize in that, but we do have people at Baker & Coulson that can. So we have to go, okay. Maria. My number is 503-666-5569. Carl?
My number is 971-229-0585.
Thank you for listening to Investing Simplified, and we'll be back next week.
We do Investing Simplified. Price Financial Group, wealth management.
You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000, or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.
Price Financial Group Wealth Management.
Navigating through today's financial investment world can seem pretty scary. Now, here's the good news. Chuck Price, president of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, introduces a new revolutionary concept that will change how you invest now and in the future. It's called Asset Lock. Asset Lock monitors your investment accounts 24/7, 365, and alerts you when action needs to be taken. And now, Chuck Price offers Asset Lock. At Price Financial Group Wealth Management, we believe all our clients deserve to have Asset Lock monitoring their accounts. So call Chuck today or online at pfgwm.com and learn how you can get Asset Lock on your accounts today for free. Price Financial Group Wealth Management, because the smart investor knows what you don't know can hurt you.
Investing Simplified.
Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000.